there is a, you know, a natural tension as one nation rises to essentially question the dominance of the other.
Rare earths may be the latest trade war weapon. It's Wednesday, May 29th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You'll find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, an indigenous triumph in Australia, recognizing facial ID concerns. Ford rolls into China, standing by necessity and peering deep into space. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The editor-in-chief of China's Global Times said Tuesday that Beijing is seriously considering restricting exports to the United States of rare earths, 17 chemical elements used in high-tech consumer electronics and military equipment. Rising trade tensions have led to concerns that Beijing will use its dominant position as a supplier of rare earths for leverage in the trade war between the United States and China. A senior official from China's National Development and Reform Commission told the Xinhua News Agency Tuesday that Beijing will give domestic demand for rare earths priority, but will meet reasonable demand from other countries. The official at China's national planning body did not directly answer whether Beijing would restrict rare earth exports to the United States. State media reported President Xi Jinping visited a rare earth company in southern China last week, lifting the shares of producers on speculation that this indicated Beijing was considering using the chemicals in the U.S. trade war. There is only one rare earth mine and processing facility in the United States. VOA Asia's Ira Melman reached the person who's in charge of the Mountain Pass mine in California. James Latinsky is co-chairman of MP Materials, which owns the mine. He asked Latinsky about what would happen if China does restrict rare earth exports to the United States.
China is a global economic power and is ascending on the geopolitical landscape. The U.S. is certainly the most powerful nation on earth, and there is a natural tension as one nation rises, you know, to essentially question the dominance of the other. And I think what we're going to see, and I think that a lot of these skirmishes, as far as the trade war, and hopefully Trump and Xi will shake hands tomorrow. But whether they shake hands or not, and whether rare earths are utilized in, you know, as part of a conflict or not, I think the bigger picture thing happening is that there is a significant, extreme amount of economic competition that is now happening between the U.S. and China that has been heightened by the trade war tensions. And frankly, regardless of what happens in the coming couple months, I don't think that that's going to recede anytime soon. I think we're at sort of a new stage of economic development in the world where you're going to see an increasing bifurcation, where you will see, you know, the U.S. economy and the, you know, China-based bloc competing geopolitically. I think the bigger picture thing is that it wouldn't surprise me, because we are sort of at the beginning stages of what is a significant change in the economic landscape.
Good for you and the United States or not?
I think that it's inevitable economic transition in the world. It has the potential to be great for everybody. It has the potential to be terrible for everybody. And it's going to, you know, the outcome is certainly going to be driven by people on, you know, both sides. And the way I see it, look, you know, I'm a proud American. I love my country. And I view my mission, and certainly the mission of MP Materials, is to perform on a level global economic playing field. We are looking to produce the lowest cost rare earth product that we can in the world and potentially grow the business from there.
One of the owners, or at least one of the owners of the company that is now operating the Mountain Pass mine, is Chinese. How does that factor in?
Yeah, so we have Shenghe, which is a public company in China and is certainly a very well-respected rare earth operator, has been our technical partner since we closed on the site a couple years ago. And they're an outstanding partner, and we've had a very productive relationship with them. And, certainly they will benefit from our success. And I think that they are, you know, working hard towards our success as we are towards our own success.
Yeah, but how does that factor in as far as the current situation is concerned?
Well, I think as far as what China would do, I think you would have to ask China that. And my guess is that that is a decision Xi will make. And, you know, that will be something that, you know, China will decide or not. And I don't know, you know, I wouldn't be the right person to opine on what the Chinese government's going to do.
Well, Chinese government, have you had conversations with anyone at the Chinese company that's part owner of your operation?
Well, they're certainly our, you know, our technical advisor and partner. And so, as you can imagine, people at our company are talking to people at their company all the time. But I think that there's something very important to recognize, which is Mountain Pass sits in California. It's actually a 50-minute drive from the Las Vegas Strip. There are 200 Americans working on that site. We are through our stage one operations. We are about to, you know, by sometime next year, we'll be through with our stage two operations, which will mean we'll be producing separated rare earths. At any one time, we may have a couple people on site sort of visiting and helping from our Chinese technical advisor. But frankly, I don't think that at this point there really would be, you know, sort of any kind of dramatic change. It's not, you know, it's not as if our partner could pick up the mine and move it to China, right? It's a gigantic ore body, and there's a, you know, $1.7 billion processing facility that's built on site, and the entire site, you know, the approximately 200 people working there are Americans. And so regardless of what happens, you know, fingers crossed, barring some event, our people will continue to work regardless of what is done. So certainly could something be done in China that would hurt a Chinese company's economic interest in our asset? Certainly. Could the Chinese government do something that would hurt us economically? Of course. But we can't, you know, it's difficult for us to figure out, you know, to kind of assess the probabilities of those events. Our goal, we are maniacally focused on being being a low-cost producer to the world. And I think that if we can be a low-cost producer to the world, particularly because we have a very environmentally friendly facility as well, that, you know, we will have a reason to exist and we will be able to exist.
Well, what happens to the final stages of the production of rare earth materials? You just told me that the last couple of steps, you have to send this material to China for the final steps. What happens then?
Yeah, well, right now, there is no question that if there were a challenge on that front, it would be very challenging for us. We were not born in flesh times. My firm acquired this site out of bankruptcy. We certainly have been able to survive through very lean times. And, you know, we're in lean times now. You know, there is a 25% tariff, today, or effective June 1, on our products going into China. And so we just need to get better. We need to get more efficient and face each challenge that comes to us each day. And it's definitely, since we were in a battle in bankruptcy for a couple years before we were even able to take control of the site. And in the couple years that we've had the site, it certainly has not been easy. And so I think we have a foundation of being able to fight through hard times. And I, you know, expect this to be no different. Certainly we don't want, you know, we don't need things to get any harder than they already are. But we will just keep moving forward.
VOA Asia's Ira Melman speaking with James Litinsky, the co-chairman of MP Materials, which owns the mine. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. The United States and Japan emphasize enhanced military cooperation. One child and one adult killed in Japanese stabbing rampage. United Nations says North Korea builds its military while its people starve. Cambodian government denies allegations of political intimidation. Stage media, rare albino panda caught on camera in China. Expanded coverage of all these stories and much more can be found, where else? On Facebook at VOA Asia and the VOAnews.com website. We continue with VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. For the first time, an Aboriginal Australian has been appointed as the Federal Minister for Indigenous Affairs. Prominent Indigenous Australians say Ken Wyatt's promotion in the re-elected centre-right government is a landmark moment. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
Ken Wyatt is Australia's first Aboriginal cabinet minister. He said in a statement on Twitter that he was incredibly honoured to be promoted to the Indigenous Affairs portfolio. He, like his predecessors, faces many challenges, including high rates of poverty, ill health and imprisonment in Aboriginal communities. His appointment was confirmed by Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison.
Australia will also have the first Indigenous Cabinet Minister in Ken Wyatt, who will take on the role of Minister for Indigenous Australians.
Indigenous leaders have welcomed the appointment. Aboriginal Australians make up about 3% of the national population of 25 million people and are among the nation's most disadvantaged groups. Dr. Jackie Huggins is the co-chair of the National Congress of Australia's First Peoples.
He's one of us. He knows where we come from. He knows our history, identity and culture. And he's had lived experience like the rest of us.
Wyatt is a former bureaucrat working in Aboriginal education and health and was awarded an Order of Australia, one of the nation's highest civic honours, in 1996. He has said previously he was inspired by Neville Bonner, the former senator who made history as the first Aboriginal person to sit in Australia's federal parliament in 1971. Wyatt is a member of the Noongar people, who've lived in Western Australia for more than 45,000 years. In 2010, he became the first Indigenous lawmaker in Australia's lower house of parliament. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Happening now in Asia, Indonesian police say four top government officials were the targets of an assassination plot that may have been linked to last week's deadly post-presidential riots in Jakarta. The national police chief says the identities of the targets were revealed after six people were arrested. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. San Francisco, California recently became the first U.S. city to ban police and other city agencies from using facial recognition technology. And the city is not alone. Dina Mitchell tells us more that people are growing wary of the powerful technology, and at the same time, others are embracing it, as in China.
San Francisco, the unofficial tech capital of the world, recently became the first U.S. city to ban facial recognition technology used by police and other officials. Those who support the ban say this type of tech is a threat to civil liberties.
The fact that law enforcement, other government agencies would be able to track every single resident as they move throughout the city, and the potential effect of chilling people's ability to engage in First Amendment protected activity is quite concerning.
This is a technology that misidentified 28 members of the United States Congress, but really can be terribly misused by governments.
China has embraced the facial recognition technology as part of its massive domestic security operation, but even uses it in some public restrooms to dispense toilet paper. Facial recognition software is not new, but it has become much more sophisticated in recent years. Apple uses facial recognition as a feature to unlock the latest iPhones. Amazon shareholders voted on two measures to limit Amazon's use of its own facial recognition technology. Both failed. Lawmakers in Washington are still assessing the technology's impact on civil rights.
We've never seen anything like this technology before.
Critics argue that facial recognition technology is sometimes flawed and fails more often when identifying women and people of color.
At a minimum, Congress should pass a moratorium on the police use of facial recognition, as the capacity for abuse, lack of oversight, and technical immaturity poses too great a risk, especially for marginalized communities.
But some on the cutting edge of biometrics say that the technology has uses that benefit humanity.
This idea that it's the bad guy, you know, there's lots of dystopian images of how biometrics could become this horrible thing, and I think that's really misplaced.
Hanson's company, Credence ID, uses facial recognition technology and other biometrics like thumbprints to help identify people in the developing world who need things like food, medical supplies, or infant formula. He thinks San Francisco's ban is too severe.
Getting rid of biometrics, it's kind of like getting rid of the internet because it can be used for bad.
Other cities in the U.S. are considering a similar ban to San Francisco's, while companies, governments, and organizations find new uses for it. What's unclear is whether any regulation on the technology can keep up as its growth explodes. Dina Mitchell for VOA News, San Francisco.
Coming up, tourism slumps in Sri Lanka. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
This news from VOA Asia, a knife-wielding attacker killed a schoolgirl and an adult while wounding another 17 people before killing himself during a rampage near Tokyo. The group of schoolgirls were waiting at a bus stop in the city of Kawasaki when assaulted. Police have not discovered a motive for the attack. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for this and much more. This is VOA Asia. As we continue with VOA Asia, Ford drives into China while tourism in Sri Lanka is down. These are the topics on today's VOA Asia business scene with Skylar Ogden.
Ford Motor Company is hoping to increase sales to upscale Chinese drivers by starting production of luxury Lincoln vehicles on the mainland this year as it cuts 10% of its global staff by eliminating 7,000 jobs. Executives say localized production will help the company benefit from lower costs and avoid the risk of tariffs. The U.S.-China trade war hasn't abated, and the most recent trade talks failed to produce any concrete results. President Trump has raised tariffs on $200 billion a year worth of Chinese goods to 25% from 10%. China announced its own plans to raise tariffs on American goods beginning on June 1st. While localized production will help avoid tariffs, automakers with plants in China could still face retaliatory measures from the government or from an angry public if relations worsen. Ford executives are hoping to reverse the collapse of Ford's business in the Asia-Pacific region, which lost $1.1 billion last year. The company will begin by building the Lincoln Corsair SUV late this year and will eventually build all of its models in China except for the Navigator. The tourism industry in Sri Lanka is suffering after the April 21st terrorist attacks, which killed more than 300 people. According to government figures, there has been an 80% drop in arrivals since the attack. In the southwest, sparkling clear waters and strong waves typically draw hundreds of tourists to the town of Hikkaduwa. But now, of the 27 hotels there, very few remain open, and the eateries that line the 3.7-mile stretch of Palm Fringe Beach are also closed. At the Lavanga Resort and Spa, General Manager Anusha Friedman tries to reassure visitors.
We, as hoteliers, we will ensure your safety.
Around 500,000 Sri Lankans directly depend on tourism for their livelihoods, with another 2 million indirectly depending on it. To help the industry cope, the government has put together a relief package that includes easy loans at special rates and reduced taxes. Desperate workers are also asking the government to lift the travel ban and enforce strict security measures so that visitors will feel safe and return to the island. But at least for now, a month after the bombings, beaches, restaurants, shops, and hotels remain empty, and workers struggle with an uncertain future. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
This news from VOA Asia: enhanced military cooperation between the United States and Japan in the face of a rising China was emphasized as President Donald Trump concluded a four-day state visit in the island nation. China was not mentioned by name, but concern about Beijing's assertive stance militarily in the Pacific was obvious. All the big stories coming your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, VOA's Rick Pantaleo takes a moment to explain how we may have landed on our 2 feet.
This is Science in a Minute.
A pair of scientists from Kansas suggest in a new study that a nearby star explosion may have played a role in forcing modern human ancestors to walk on 2 feet. The study suggests a supernova may have bombarded Earth 2.6 million years ago with so much cosmic radiation that it flooded the lower atmosphere with electrons. The researchers suggest this surge in atmospheric ionization set off a huge increase in cloud-to-ground lightning strikes that set off forest fires around the world. It's thought the fires forced human ancestors, who were accustomed to climbing and living in trees, out of the forests and onto grassy and open savannas. The researchers propose that our ancient relatives were then forced to walk across the grasslands, but to look out for predators, had to learn to walk upright on 2 feet. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Every year, astronomers are seeing farther and more clearly into the cosmos than ever before. One of the ways they're doing it is by linking telescopes together to make them more powerful. The Very Large Array in New Mexico, supported by the National Science Foundation, is one incredible example. VOA's Kevin Enix peeks into the vastness of space.
Welcome to the Very Large Array, or VLA as it is called. It's a complex of 27 massive antennas in New Mexico, all pointing skyward.
We use the Very Large Array, which we operate from the plains of San Agustin in New Mexico, to study the radio emission from the cosmos.
With support from the National Science Foundation, astronomers like Claire Chandler are using this facility to observe the universe. Star birth, star death, black holes, colliding galaxies, these and more are all in a day's work at the VLA.
What the radio does is that it reveals those physical processes in ways that you simply can't see in the optical and the infrared.
You may be thinking the VLA detects sound. Not exactly, says Mark McKinnon, who oversees operations for the VLA in New Mexico.
There's a bit of a disconnect in that radio waves are not heard. Acoustic waves are what we hear with our ears. That's the distinction, is a radio wave is still a part of the electromagnetic spectrum, just at a much longer wavelength than what our eyes are accustomed to seeing.
Interpreting radio images can be challenging. They often look like a lot of blobs, but to the trained eye, they have a lot to tell.
This is actually an image of an elliptical galaxy that was observed with the Hubble Space Telescope. So the pink emission here that you see is actually the radio emission. All of this energetic plasma that's being spewed out of that supermassive black hole in the center of that galaxy, which we would not even know about if we didn't have the VLA.
A main focus of Chandler's research, star formation, which happens inside vast clouds of gas containing hydrogen and other molecules.
This is a simulation, a computer simulation of what we think the collapse of a molecular cloud might look like. And it was done, it was published over 15 years ago now.
See those swirls? Astronomers theorized that this is what starbirth looks like. But for a long time, they didn't have actual observations to confirm it. Advances in radio astronomy changed that.
You can see exactly that swirling material, just like the simulation. And, you know, this was the first time we'd ever seen this.
Understanding the mechanics of the universe by deciphering its radio emissions. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. VOA Asia mourns the loss of Australian reporter and journalist Ron Corbin. While he also contributed to other media outlets, longtime listeners have heard many of Ron's excellent reports from Thailand, where he had worked since 1989. Our condolences go out to his family, as we too will miss hearing from him. We hope you and your family are doing well, and we invite you to join us again tomorrow for another edition of VOA Asia.